Good. So it's working. So today is Wednesday, October 13th, 2010. I'm Rick Hansen. And tonight, what I'd like to explore with you is the deep roots of the suffering that's related to fear. To put this in context, as you know, we've been exploring mindfulness in general, and recently, mindfulness of that of the feeling tone of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral following the Buddha's structure. And we put a fair amount of attention on what happens when we chase after what's pleasant but not necessarily good for us. And then we've been lately moving more into what happens in our reactions to what's unpleasant with what the Buddha called aversion. Or in a traditional word that is very broad in its what it encompasses, hatred. And so in particular, I'd like to pick up the thread with regard to fear, explore its deep roots, explore why it does keep arising, and then in particular, some things you can do about it. And try to preserve at least 15 minutes toward the end for discussion. So to begin with, to ground this in something experiential, I invite you to be aware of what I encourage you to be mindful of during the meditation, which is to say a kind of almost automatic, subtle background trickle of anxiety in your own mind that is sort of prior to content. It doesn't have a particular object to it. There's nothing in particular that's triggering it. It just, in effect, it's looking for something to be afraid of, if anything. Kind of a subtle background, either continuous or sort of arising and fading away, and arising and fading away frequently, sense of subtle apprehension or unease or kind of a scanning with your ears or your eyes or your mind. Some kind of subtle background anxiety. So first of all, how many of you have any sense of that? Okay, I'm glad actually, because biologically, it's going in all of us all the time. And I'll explain more deeply why in a minute, but it really is a subtle ongoing anxiety that I'll come back to. It's the seed bed from which spikes and sprouts and stalks of anxiety, like Jack and the Beanstalk, you know, grow at warp speed in the mind from that ground. And then in terms of those stalks, those spikes, pick something in your life current for you that is moderately worrying to you. Don't pick anything that's terribly frightening, or don't bring up old horrifying trauma if that unfortunately has happened to you, but rather something current in your mind that you have nagging worrying about. It could be a child or a friend or a pet or a loved one or your own situation. Maybe you've gotten a health scare recently, or you have other reasons to worry about your health or your finances. These days, quite often people are worried about their finances in one way or another. Or whether you'll be able to accomplish something important to you. Or move on, or ever find love again, or whatever it is for you. So just take a moment there to be aware of whatever that is, and in particular be mindful of the experience of worry or anxiety or fear. Be aware of the body sensations of fear in this regard. Including any tightening in your body, bracing. And then also, you know, the emotions of fear, ranging from very subtle apprehension to quite intense worry and alarm. And also be aware of the extent to which whatever it is that you're worrying about is not here right now, that it's in the future. It's a possibility, but it's not here right now. Be aware of that, to whatever extent that's true too. Okay, come on back. And so, briefly, any quick observations about the actual experience of fear? Familiar. Okay, thank you. And kind of a contraction. Right, very much in your case, right there, it's anticipation. It's about something that's not here. It's anticipatory. A lot, yeah.
I was aware of a pre-tensioning to clamp off.
Yeah.
It was a lot more noticeable than anything in the other direction, but it depends on the relax. It was like, you wouldn't take much to go.
Oh, how interesting. Yeah. Right. The forces that are ready to quickly take you to alarm are more powerful than the forces that are going to quickly take you to cosmic surrender, right? And ease and inner peace, right? Yeah. One more?
I am here very kind of angry at something I just stumbled onto. And, you know, it's simply fear of unreliability.
Yeah.
That is that.
And yeah.
I'm not particularly annoyed with the inconvenience what they did to me. I don't know. It's just worry that this is an unreliable person to remain on in the future, not to blunder and screw up. I believe that word, second word, fuck up again.
Yeah. Got it. Yeah. Got it.
So it's fear. It's just fear.
Yeah. Beneath the anger, yeah. Last person, right there.
So it's not necessarily based on what has happened or is going to happen on the reality of the situation.
Correct. Sometimes we're afraid of something that's real right here and now. You know, let's say we really got a letter from the IRS that said, you know, we found a major mistake and we're going to audit your returns for the last 3 years. Make out your will and get a good lawyer. You know, it's a real condition, right? Or the doctor has said, that's a real lump and, it's a real thing. On the other hand, often our worries are about the future, really, where we worry that someone will let us down in the future, or a bad event will occur in the future, or that we will not attain a goal in the future. I mean, often. Okay. So you get a sense of it. You know, fear has a range to it. It can be in the body. It has attitudes. There are different kinds of things to be afraid of. You know, but yet you would have to acknowledge that fear is quite prevalent. And fundamentally, does it feel like a pleasant experience? Yeah. So it is a kind of suffering, a bit. It's at least unpleasant. Okay. So why do we suffer fundamentally? And in particular, why do we suffer fear? Why are we afraid? And as you know, the Buddha said, I teach one thing, suffering in its end. You know, the first noble truth is the noble truth of suffering, the fact of suffering. Why is there suffering? Why do animals suffer? Why do we suffer? I think the answer to that question is in three fundamental ways in which, to stay alive, organisms have to, in effect, temporarily violate the laws of nature. First, any organism, to stay alive, whether it's a little virus or bacteria, or a big elephant or blue whale, or us somewhere in between, has to create a boundary between itself and the world. It has to separate itself from the world. There has to be an outer, there has to be an inner. Second, also to survive, every organism has to kind of keep things the same around a healthy equilibrium, around a healthy set point within range, and the changes within that range move smoothly rather than abruptly or chaotically. Okay? And third, to survive, every organism has to pursue those things that are rewarding and get them, and it has to avoid those things that are dangerous and lethal. Right? That's fundamental. And you can see that at all scales, whether it's the scale of you know, not wanting your body to be penetrated by something that could kill you and breach that self-world boundary, or scaled up to getting uncomfortable socially, you know, if someone starts breaking the glass and getting really close, or, you see what I mean, or even psychologically breaking a boundary of giving unwanted advice. So these happen in all kinds of scales, you know. Take the last one, needing to get a reward or avoid a pain, you know, at a subtle, at a very fundamental, visceral level, hold your breath here for 20 seconds. Ready? 1, 2, 3. Actually, let's do this. Blow all the way out. Don't inhale. Blow all the way out and don't inhale until I say so. Do you want to breathe? Okay, inhale. Right there. So visceral. You feel the panic starting to rise. Right? That's about 5 seconds starting to rise. And I apologize for, you know, doing that in a way, but right there is a great experiment. And more subtly, all the way up, you know, think of subtle goals we have, subtle attainments that we pursue, you know, in terms of subtleties of feedback coming to us from other people, or the meanings of certain events in our life, or things we want in our environment. Okay. The problem is that each one of those very legitimate aims or drives related to survival at all scales and thriving at all scales runs right up against the way it actually is. And when those needs are unmet, if you will, for a boundary, number one, number two, a kind of stasis, and number three, the attainment of carrots in the avoidance of sticks, when there's any kind of frustration or difficulty or disturbance in those aims, alarm signals go off. They go off inside bacteria or protozoa that will swim towards sugar and away from salt. They go off in little crabs that will scuttle away from quick movements. They go off in us when we can't, you know, get a breath yet. Those alarm bells go off. And the problem is that those subtle alarms keep going off all the time because we're not fundamentally separated from the world. Without even getting cosmic, to live, we have to metabolize. We have to exchange resources with the world. We have to take in from the world and give out into the world. A large fraction of the atoms in your body changes every year. It's quite remarkable, actually, particularly the ones that are not in things like bone, you know. They get exchanged every year. We have to have transactions with other people. We have to have, you know, some kind of porous filters. We have to be affectable by other people. Otherwise, we can't really stay alive. But when that sense of boundary gets breached in different ways, that separation gets breached, it's subtly alarming. Also, whenever our inner equilibria, and there's so many of them, there are thousands, tens of thousands, physical and psychological systems within systems within systems within systems of systems, right? All the way up. And when any one of those systems is disturbed, when it's, you know, is organized around a not right set point, or it goes out of range, or it starts changing too fast, signals of alarm start distributing through the whole body mind from at all levels. Again, and that's happening all the time because you cannot live without being disturbed. We're constantly disturbed by life. Right? It's really true, isn't it? At all levels. And then last, you know, in terms of getting carrots and avoiding sticks, you know, it's hard to get carrots. We often don't get all the carrots we want. And as soon as you get a carrot, it's gone, right? You know, rewards are continually falling away. Threats are all around us. Things happen. Things come at us. You know, there is no perfect safety in this world. No one is fundamentally safe from old age, disease, and death, or being separated one way or another someday by everything that you love. Right? So there too, there's an inevitable triggering of these alarm signals that's subtle and deep in the body-mind. Fear is our condition. Right? Fear is the natural state. Other things are present too in the natural state, but it's natural to be afraid. So first off, if you feel ashamed of being afraid, right? Or it's not cool to be afraid. You know, I think I said this once before, the classic is that it's uncool for men to acknowledge fear, uncool for women to acknowledge anger as a generalization. So what do you end up with? A bunch of men who are afraid of women who are angry with them, right? So that's a generalization. But with regard to fear, it's natural to be afraid. So what are we going to do about this? This is where I think the Buddha's teachings are very, very relevant and helpful. The first is to appreciate that this inherent background, at a minimum, relentlessly intermittent, and actually I think much of the time an ongoing trickle, that can be understood as what he called dukkha. Dukkha is a word for suffering. He means that word dukkha in two kinds of ways. One way he means it, and the root of it is interesting, as I've described in here. The word dukkha means, du means not right, ka is where an axle intersects the hub of a wheel. So it's like a not right intersection. It's not quite balanced perfectly. I think of it as a wobbly grinding, right? A subtle background wobbly grinding. Doesn't that kind of really get at the kind of fundamental nature of it? It's a wonderful metaphor. And it really gets to the bottom. So much of this dukkha, it's not traumatic. On the 0 to 10 scale of yuck, it's a 1. It's a 0.4. But it keeps coming, right? And it's kind of the seedbed from which other more intense forms of dukkha arise. And then he described dukkha-dukkha, which is our reactions that bring suffering to that root suffering. What's interesting is that this root experience that initially when it enters the mind comes like an unwanted visitor with unpleasantness. Right? If we can simply be with it, in other words, if we can simply be with that subtle trickle of anxiety, that subtle trickle of apprehension or wariness, and not resist it, and not get angry at it, or run from it, or get lost in it. If we can simply, in a sense, be mindful of it as kind of just almost a sensation or a content, just a pure content of mind, something very interesting happens. It stops being unpleasant. It's simply a subtlety of apprehension in the body. It's simply a kind of body sensation or inclination, basically an inclination to flee or to fight. But that's all it is. It's just that. Or as Bill would say, it's that. Right? And that's good. It's that. Or there it is. That's another way of putting it. There it is. Fear is here. There is fear, there is apprehension, there is tension. That's it. But when you just kind of open to it, this is the first practice of the Buddha. I'm going to go through four. This is the first of the four. Right there, there's a kind of opening, a kind of relaxing, a kind of undoing. And right there, suffering ends. that kind of suffering at least. What I invite you to explore this for yourself. First, you have to be aware of it. You have to be aware of this kind of basic, fundamental, subtle quality of apprehension. Try to walk down the street. You know rationally it's safe, but watch little subtleties of alarm or anxiety or wariness or watchfulness or tension, or bracing come up. And then, if you can, let it just be that without resisting it. And very often, I think what you'll experience is it stops being powerful. It stops being something that's not liked. It's simply a sensation. A second thing a person can do is, if you think about it, so much of what we fear, as you saw, is in the future. And that the alternative, which is to simply be in the present. What's here right now? And I've taken that on myself as, because I'm anxious by disposition. And people vary in their temperaments, But I've really taken on myself this practice of trying to come back into the moment, and ask myself, is it basically all right now? Almost always the answer is yes. It's basically all right now. It may not be perfect, but it's basically all right now. And in fact, if you tune in to certain core sensations in your body, unless tuning into your body is alarming and then pick something else, you'll notice that, wait a second, there's a basic all rightness in the feeling of breathing. Or there's a basic all rightness in the body as a whole. You're really okay. And I think there the opportunity in terms of practicing with fear is honestly multiple times a day, including in settings where you start to feel sort of threatened or pushed or pressed or stressed, to come back to what is okay right now and do a little bit of an inventory. And then as you recognize and register what is okay right now, you let yourself soften around it and feel it and open to a kind of, it's all right now. In my mind it comes up as, the war's over. It's all right. It's all right. It's all right. What comes up in my mind is a kind of kindness to, as I said before, the animal of the body that's so sweet and yet and afraid. The body is afraid for you, in a sense, to keep you alive. Poor body, so afraid. It's all right. You can settle down now. It's like a pet or a horse that's alarmed, by a twig or a stick in the trail. It's all right. It's all right. You might even run your hands over your thighs, as I'm doing, like soothing or settling the poor body. It's okay. It's all right. I'm breathing. It's all right. That's a very intimate practice. And those are ways to be now. Another way, I'll leave it at that. Third practice is compassion. It's so interesting that compassion for ourselves or others, love. Remember that famous book title, Love is Letting Go of Fear? Chempulski? Beautiful book, beautiful deep teaching. It feels that way, isn't it? Or letting go of fear is love, right? That when we bring a kind of compassion to ourselves as the one who is afraid, the one who is fearful, it eases the fearfulness, right? The fear, the anxiety, the bracing, the tension is held in a larger space. And also a way to address our own sense of anxiety or tension and so forth is to have compassion for fear in others. It's really quite something to watch micro expressions in people's faces. And you can watch fear flit across their face. You don't need to be Paul Ekman or the main character in Lie to Me, which is worth watching, I think, on Fox Channel 2, to be able to do this, to just see fear in other people, and to realize sometimes in interacting with an intimate or a friend or a person at work that they're nervous about something. They're anxious, and maybe it's you, right? Or maybe it's what you said, or what you could do. As many people have said, they're afraid of you. You know, I remember the S training a long time ago, 1975. I don't know how many of you ever did the S training. Yay! Brothers, sisters, Essies! You know, anyway, well, you may recall the danger process. Basically, they do a series of things that really stir up fear. Then they have everybody lie on the floor and close their eyes, and without touching anyone near them, just play, essentially, with acting out the fear. Just imagining that you're really scared, you know, the people are near you are going to hurt you and scream and yell. And then they have you realize that just like you're afraid of everybody else, they're all afraid of you, right? And there's a kind of transformation that occurs when you realize that other people are afraid too, right? And then the last thing I want to say in terms of methods and so forth, the Buddha was very clear about doing what's practical. You know, do what's practical. And so in terms of the part of fear that's a lot about not getting carrots or not avoiding sticks, I think there are two key practices about that. First, very often there's something that we're afraid of, we're worried about, we're anticipating especially, and then it's a great question to ask yourself, you know, would I survive it? You know, could I get through it? Could I manage it? Right? Would it be ultimately I could deal with it? Could I deal with it? Wouldn't be my preference, but could I deal with it? Almost always the answer is yes. You know? And then sometimes what happens is we find our way to being able to deal with it. At first we think, no, I couldn't deal with that. I couldn't deal with my parent dying. Right? Or I couldn't deal with having to put my pet down, my dog down. Or I couldn't deal with, you know, being alone for the rest of my life. And then you look more into it and you realize, you know, I really could deal with it. Because we all are going to have to deal with old age, disease, death, loss, transition, moving on. We all will deal with it, right? We can deal with it. So that's a practice right there to explore, can I deal with it? And find it over time, if you can, that you really can deal with it. And then last, there is the practice of actually taking action. One of the most important things in terms of dealing with the anxiety or fear that's about unfulfilled hopes, in other words, unfulfilled carrot seeking, or you know, fears of bad things happening, is that the organism naturally wants to respond. And it's when it gets frustrated in its natural response that it suffers. So this week to come, basically, I invite you to do two things. I invite you to soften around generic fear, that first generic fear, that first level of fear, that kind of automatic, ongoing trickle of fear that's just embedded in our biology. And see if you can soften around it and not, in effect, not react to it. Let it be, as the Buddha said, the first dart, but don't throw second darts. Try to just soften around it and not necessarily make it meaningful or take it seriously. Think of it as a little bit like emotional tinnitus, like that background ringing in the ears. It's a background sound. It's not wished for, but there it is, but it's not meaningful. Second, pick some important area in your life where there is a kind of nagging anxiety or concern. Because very often that nagging anxiety or concern is a friend knocking on your door that's saying, take action. Do something about this. If you don't want to be alone for the rest of your life, take steps to reduce the likelihood of that happening. If you're worried about money, take steps in that regard. If you've got concerns about your health, do something. If you're getting the feeling that you're drinking too much or eating too many cupcakes, whatever it is, you know, take action about that. You know, action really reduces anxiety. Okay. Comments? Questions? Okay, Harold?
It's interesting that you picked this. I remember when I first became aware of this background level, and I was, gee, what an awful thing to discover. What's wrong with me? And I asked James Barras about that. I had an opportunity to work with him for a little bit, and he basically gave me this an acronym and some practice around it, the RAIN. You may have gone over this at one point, but in any case, as you said, recognize it first. Accept it, okay, it's there, I see it, it's there, and then investigate it in the body. How does it feel? Where does it feel? And in so doing, you get able to separate it from the I. It's not me.
Yeah, N for not self.
It's, you kind of non-identify, that's the final N in the RAIN, is to non-identify. Mm-hmm. And those four steps allow you to separate from it, and then you can move on to be happy with it or accept it as a friend and take action. And in talking about it, he said, and it's not just for these subtle things, you can use the same principle for big things that are problems.
Great, thank you. Yeah. Right there, yeah.
In your last hour clock before you left, one of your last comments was to try to reduce unnecessary fear. And I've been really becoming a lot more aware of that it's just fearful thought. And, you know, I walk around my neighborhood and I become more aware of, like, thought, you know, where I create anxiety in my thinking. And it's been very liberating to just, like, it's like a bubble that pops. You know, it's just a cloud. It's been really useful.
Great.
So, thank you.
Oh, good. Great. Yeah. Yeah. Diane?
Yeah, when you were talking about the flee or fight, that it's just part of the inclination, contents of the mind, and what about freeze? Is
sure.
That, would you include that? With
yeah,
the,
I should have mentioned it too.
Well, I just was curious.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I think that when I go into a freeze, it borders on also being maybe some denial, you know, so I might have the fear, but it's way down there, and what I have to get through first is a bit of the freeze or a denial about it to really, oh yeah, I really have some fear about that, but I kind of ride above it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that what's for me been very useful is to appreciate the fact that in the mind, the brain, you know, the brain is doing this. It pairs typically perceptions and action inclinations, right? It pairs emotions. Fear is an emotion. It's a very powerful evolutionarily emergent signal that gets organisms motivated, and it's usually paired with some action inclination, like freezing or fighting or fleeing or appeasing in more social animals. Those are kind of the big four, typically. And so the trick that I'm getting at here is at this primal level to just kind of track it as almost like wallpaper, you know, almost like grout in daily life, and then open to the dukkha of it. In other words, don't fight it. Don't react to it. And interestingly, it in amazing ways typically and often melts as some kind of unpleasantness. It kind of melts when you actually open to it and accept it just as sensation or action inclination or just emotion. Yeah. Okay, back there, you? Yeah, right here. Yeah.
Thought it was the theme seemed to be one of the accepted
thoughts about a conversation about the kind of what I'm going to say to make sure I'm accepted and not rejected. And then when I look further, it still kind of surprises me. It still seems a little strange if the theme was more being drawn to people and being kind of repelled by people who wouldn't help the tribe survive. Or the pack.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of aha experience. So then I started just really staying with that theme and watching thoughts that came up. And sure enough, they fall into, oh, that person's, oh, I don't like that person. Oh, not very aware the pack wouldn't survive. Oh, that person overreacts. He'd jump off the raft and knock us all off. You know, and it seems almost a little insane. But it's what it is, you know.
Yeah.
And the more I look at it, the more I see that holds up.
Yeah, thank you. How about one more person? Yeah.
It's in the form of a question.
Uh-huh.
At times I'll be talking to other people and there's a conflict where I feel they're being demanded, you know, or whatnot, and I feel it in my body. And I'm not exactly sure how to respond in my body at that time, because I feel if I work on my body, that's the best way. So to address my question, I guess, would it be like just deep breaths and long exhales? I'm not sure the best way to work on my body in that situation.
You mean what helps you be aware in your body?
No, what will make me more stand up for myself, or just be strong, because I can feel my breath contracting and I have difficulty responding out of the fear that I feel in my body.
Yeah.
Something with my body at that point in time.
Yeah.
I'll be stronger.
That's great. Well, so, you know, question there, of course, is what to do with fear that is getting in the way of an adaptive response, you know, a wholesome response, a self-kind response, right? And I think there are a number of things a person can do, so I'll just name a handful and see what could be useful for you, okay? So one, paradoxically, is to step back, physically even, or certainly emotionally. Like, for example, buy yourself a little time, or put a little distance between you and the other person, or imagine a wall. I'll sometimes imagine a glass wall, like the glass that they use in a submarine that's a foot thick, you know, in its windows deep underwater where the pressure is like 1,000 pounds per square inch or something. You know, in other words, paradoxically, act on the fear. You know, do what it's telling you to do. It's telling you to back up, get away, you know, put some daylight between you and this threat. A second thing is to call to mind the felt sense of being with others who care about you. Because we are profoundly social animals who desperately need to be part of the pack, really, to feel safe. Being separated from the pack was a death sentence in the Serengeti. A very telling statistic related to that came to my attention when I was writing my first book, Mother Nurture, and I saw a graph from your perspective against time of the number of single mothers in America going back to the Revolutionary War or something, from census records all the way to the present time. And it goes like this from about 1750 to about, you know, 1940, and then it starts rising. But prior to that post-war period, it was about 4%, which was basically a short-term statistic. At any moment in time, maybe 4% of the mothers were quote-unquote single. But basically, in nature, you can't be a single mother because you can't take care of a little kid, right? You can be a mother or you can be single, but you can't be both, you know, in the wild. I mean, we're so dependent, so dependent. So bringing to mind, I mean, again, just quick sense, your friend. Bring to mind a sense of a friend, someone who has your back, someone who's just total go-to, you know, and maybe someone who feels strong, or a group of people who feel like they're on your side, they're powerful, they're intense. I mean, it's great to even bring to mind an internal committee or, you know, I forget the Napoleon Hill term, a mastermind group, there we go. Or just your folks, your peeps, they're with you, your posse, you know, your band. They're on your side. That's really, seriously. And if you don't have some clarity about that, develop that group and imagine talking with them and really, you know, open up to the good things they're going to tell you. But especially bring to mind that felt sense. That's very important for being strong. And then third, I think something that helps is to take on the body sensations of strength. And offline, do some practices with them, particularly if it's not immediately easy for you to access that resource state. You know, so offline, bring to mind, what's it like to lift weight with real intensity? Or whatever it is you do physically. Everybody usually does something that they do, they have some intensity for. Or bring to mind what it was like to stick up for someone you really cared about, you know, or stand tall, or breathe, you know, be the real deal in a tough situation, right? And feel it in your body. I mean, for me, it's rock climbing often. Certain other memories that are like body memories of just not having anything to do with a certain kind of BS that was coming down in a group setting I was in. Just what that like in your body. Or it can help also to imagine certain people who for you are exemplars of healthy strength and what it feels like, what it would feel like to be in their body. That's a great method too. Imagine your way into their body. You know, right now I'm imagining Mike Singletary, coach of the 49ers, you know, just kind of what that's like, you know, Pro Bowl, Hall of Fame, linebacker, yet also a very decent guy, wears a big cross around his neck, not a violent person, but, you know, really strong, or whatever your version of that is. And then, I think I'll tell you the last one for me that's been a huge one and saved my life, and I think my inner life in a lot of ways, which was to take refuge in the truth. Truth is your ultimate refuge. What are the facts? I mean, I don't mean truth, cosmic truth. I mean the basic facts. And then take refuge in your capacity to see the truth and to name the truth, which could be right now, I'm feeling some fear. Right now, you're talking really fast and loud. The truth actually is that the contract says X, not Y. The truth actually is that the email I sent you was dated yesterday, not a week ago. Whatever it is. And take refuge in your ability to see the truth and name the truth, minimally to yourself, and as appropriate, outward to the other person. That's a great refuge. You're just the messenger of reality. That's a great refuge. I'm taking refuge in truth as I know it. I'm willing to discover that what I thought was factually the case is not factually the case. So there's integrity in it. And I'm even open to you, who are acting pretty threatening right now and out of line. If you can point out to me what's not true here. But I'm interested in discovering what's true and taking my stand in what's true, including the truth of the agreements we have with each other. Do you get what I'm saying there? That's a really powerful one. And internally you go, yeah, I'm just saying what's true. It's best I know. You know? Which goes to where I'd like to close tonight before we sit for a moment. And I apologize for going past 8:30 again. But I got a beautiful email from, there's a nunnery, I don't know if that's quite the right word, of Buddhist nuns in San Francisco. And they had some teachers come visiting who are female monastics in the Buddhist Theravada tradition. And an email, you can get on their email list if you look into it. And I can either connect you with them or you can just Google, I think, Theravada Nuns San Francisco. You'll get to it. I think the official name is, yeah, Sarana Loka. Sarana Loka. Great place. Anyway, they had a teaching about courage. It's a good way to end here. They said, essentially, who was it that Ananda Bodhi and Santa Citta. So Ajahn Santa Citta shared a definition for the word courage. This is not the absence of fear, but making the decision that there is something more important than fear. Isn't that beautiful? It's not the absence of fear. Courage is not the absence of fear. In other words, the body is afraid. the body is bred to be afraid, right? Bodies that were not afraid did not pass on their genes. There's no end to fear. There's no end to that dukkha. We can end our reactions to that dukkha, which interestingly often undoes the dukkha, the root dukkha itself. But what we can have is courage, in which we basically make a decision that there is something more important than fear, more important, a higher value. You know, feel the fear and do it anyway. Feel the fear and speak truth to power nonetheless. Right? And then Sister Ajahn, rather, Ajahn means 10 years of monastic practice, typically 10 rains retreats. Ajahn Ananda Bodhi picked up on this theme, challenging us to include the fear when it is present and then to act on the deeper intention. As she said, cultivating inner strength is less about becoming or striving. Rather, it is about creating the conditions for wisdom, compassion, and truth to be lived through us, which can happen if we simply open our hearts. So with that, how about we sit for a minute? Softening and opening around fear rather than contracting, which is what the mind habitually tries to do. Softening and opening around fear, letting it pass through. Moving through a space of much larger intentions. Intentions such as for love, awakening, and peace. I look forward to seeing you all at the potluck next week. I have gotten a lot of emails. People are bringing some serious goodies. One of my very best friends is bringing some amazing chocolate cake, etc. 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock.